Oh, please. How could you? I've got no idea what music is for. It's just such an interesting question. I suppose one of the things that reveals itself when you start going deeply into a question is that there isn't an answer that's suddenly going to satisfy you. Because everything you discover just has another question in it. So you just have to keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. And it becomes a sort of, how can you put it? It becomes a very compelling journey.
It was at that moment that I understood what she was teaching me.
There was no chance to be destroyed or really be created there. Just lived. And that's okay for some people, but I always felt something different stirring in me. Because I knew there was stuff inside me that could, like, flower. Maybe it would really ruin me. Maybe I'd feel really shitty about it. But at least it would come out. There was no place for it to surface.
And the question is, well, why do you know that?
You're late.
Well, the important thing about tape is that it transforms something that existed in time and therefore wasn't durable into something that exists in space and is durable, and is not only durable but is malleable in lots of different ways. Once music is recorded on tape, it's just pieces of ferrous oxide on plastic, and it can therefore be chopped about, switched around.
You may not know his name, but if you've been to an airport or logged onto a computer, you will have heard his music.
Put together in different orders, stretched, compressed.
Brian Eno is the father of what's termed ambient music.
Whatever.
Really funny story about Brian, actually, because one day we decided we were going to make record an EP based on the four elements: earth, air, fire, water. And it was going to be Ghost Riders in the Sky for air, The Green Green Grass of Home for earth, River of Tears for water, and God, what was the other one? Ring of Fire. So we had these four fantastic kind of country and western songs, and we were going to do this EP. But Brian, unfortunately, or fortunately, had bought a bottle of tequila. Down, 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 and the flames were higher, and the ring of fire. And so we started drinking this tequila and discussing. It was all going to be a cappella, or else accompanied by one very cheesy keyboard. But then, I don't quite know how it happened, we ended up recording a very, very harmonised version of Que Sera Sera instead, which strangely was never released. It's like two very drunk people wondering how many more harmonies they can add. The future's not ours, ours to see. The ring of fire, the ring of fire. I'm Clodagh Simmons, I'm an experimental musician, and this is the story of an exercise in the unexpected. I'll start at the beginning. I was living in London in 1976. I'd been there about 6 years. I was living with my then boyfriend, Willie Murray, who was a drummer in a band we'd both been in. And the band had not fared very well, and it broke up fairly soon. And so we both ended up in kind of day job hell, basically. Because London at that time in the 70s, there were kind of coal strikes, there were garbage strikes, there was a 3-day working week, or was it a 4-day working week? It was pretty dismal.
With all this, escalating prices and an inflation in violence which matches the inflation of monetary value.
Joseph.
No way.
Listening to the music here instead of anywhere else, right? Why are you frustrated? Everyone is.
Because we have mommy.
Everyone is. Why? Anywhere. You're frustrated. It's a normal part of life.
I learned that the only hope of shaking free of your own description of music was to place yourself in such an untenable position that you had to figure out something new.
And then my grandmother died and left me a little bit of money, and we both decided immediately that we'd go to New York. We'd go to New York for 3 weeks and try and get a record deal. And suddenly you went to this place where there was this very high energy, everything was positive, everybody was friendly. Gosh, we fell in love with it very quickly. Virgin Records had just opened an office there, and we were very friendly with Richard Branson and also Mike Oldfield, who'd been in a previous band with Willie. And so they had said, we've got a tiny office in New York, why don't you look them up? Part of my job, it soon transpired, was that when a test pressing came in, like a white label vinyl, somebody had to make sure the tracks were in the right order, they were the same names as the names on the sleeve, and so on and so forth. And one day, after I'd been there, I think only about a month, a test pressing came in, and this music came on, and I couldn't go on working. I remember just my jaw dropping into my lap. And I remember saying to the other people, what on earth is this? And they said, oh, that's Phil's new album. And I said, but who's Phil? And they said, well, you know Phil. And I said, no, I don't. I've never heard anything like this. I've no idea who Phil is. They said, well, you know Phil and Kurt. And then I couldn't believe it. I said, not Phil and Kurt. And they said, yep. Because these two people used to come into the office once a week, Phil and Kurt, and I thought they were somebody's roadies because they kind of looked like roadies. They were pretty scruffy and wore lumberjack shirts. And Kurt was very tall with sort of long, lanky hair. Phil had very curly hair and, you know, didn't look like prosperous rock stars, let's put it that way. All I knew is there had to be a check every Thursday or whenever. And they'd come in on a Thursday and you had to make sure they got their check. So when it was revealed that this was Phil's album, I was completely over the moon. And the next time he came in, I actually, to my own faint disbelief, I got down on my knees and kissed his shoe. And he was like, oh, Claude, what are you doing? Oh, what are you doing? And I said, my God, Phil, I thought you were somebody's roadie. I had no idea that this was what you did. And I think that album is absolutely incredible. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. So that started off a friendship, because everyone else in the Virgin office, apart from the guy who had signed him, wasn't that mad about him. So, but when I first heard that music, I just remember thinking, my God, this is, you know, this is something else.
That's exactly what happens when you are, when you find your place, yourself in a place of total ignorance of that kind. And that's a place where you can begin again. You can begin learning again. You know, the difficulty with any, it's not just artists or musicians, but with anybody in any ordinary part of life, or walk of life, the difficulty we have is how do we continue to learn.
New York is the thing that seduced me. New York is the thing that formed me. New York is the thing that deformed me. New York is the thing that converted me. New York is the thing that converted me. New York's the thing I love, too.
I've always said to younger composers, it's not how do you find your voice, but how to get rid of it. It's getting the voice isn't hard, it's getting rid of the damn thing.
A couple of months after that, Kurt Mankesi, who was his producer, when he found out that I was a singer, I think Willie and I did a couple of demos with him. which Phil had heard, and Phil decided he liked my voice. So I got this phone call from Phil one day saying, "Oh, Clodagh, yeah, I was wondering, we usually work with Joan LaBarbera," who was a brilliant, kind of technically brilliant singer. And she was, I can't remember, she was pregnant or she was sick, and he had a performance coming up of Music in 12 Parts, which I hadn't heard. And he asked me if I would consider doing the singing in Joan's absence. So I said, well, maybe, you know, can you send me the album and I'll listen to it. The singing on it was extraordinarily complicated and technically super challenging. And I couldn't figure out where she was breathing. I couldn't figure out how she was singing the way she sang. It seemed like she wasn't taking a breath anywhere. So I rang him back and I said, "Well, I've listened to it and it sounds pretty difficult, but maybe if you just send me a score, you know, I'll take a look at it." And that's when he said, "Oh, Clodagh, there's no score. Oh, no, it's all improvised." And I said, "Do you know what? I think maybe not." So that was the first great, probably a huge kind of career miss for me, turning down Philip Glass. But I know that it was the right thing to do, because there is no way I could have done it. But it is, it does make quite a funny story.
But at the same time, you know that they were made by people just having a really good time and really going, "Hey, look at this, all these knobs, whoa."
There was another strange thing that happened around that time, which was that I broke up with Willie, my then boyfriend. And after a couple of, I started going out with another guy. And I remember one day we went to see the Mevlevi Dervishes, who were doing a turning ceremony at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. And it went on for about an hour and a half or 2 hours. And it was absolutely extraordinary. And I'd never seen anything like that before, and I'd never heard that music before. And I was completely transfixed, so much so that by the end of it, I couldn't speak, and I felt like I didn't want to speak for about a month. But this guy who I'd started dating kind of got up and clapped his hands together and said, "Oh, so shall we go for a burger?" And I just remember thinking, that's it. That's the end of this relationship. We are from entirely different planets. And I just became much more interested over a fairly short period of time then in music from other cultures and stuff like that, which wasn't that common in those days. There weren't that many people who were interested in, you know, obscure albums on UNESCO labels and stuff. But I began listening to a lot of things like that, you know, tribes in Azerbaijan and so on. But there was no such phrase as world music in those days. That came later. And it was suddenly as if the disillusionment I felt with working for a record label was somehow blending with, you know, discovering all these different things, different music from different parts of the world, completely different attitudes to music. And I just found it all so much more interesting than this idea I'd gone out with, which is, you know, I'm going to go and get a record deal. Suddenly it just didn't interest me much anymore. The thing that's striking when you look back on it was how full of unexpectedness as it was. You know, it just, for one thing, I never expected I would stay in New York. For another thing, all the things I expected would happen didn't happen. And a whole bunch of stuff I never saw coming came. It kind of changed the direction of my life, really. I came back, you know, a very different person than I'd gone out. Very enriched, I think, by what happened. But none of it had been anything like what I thought I was going to head into. And so the funny thing is, when I look back, this funny picture has emerged of what it was like. And it's summed up so beautifully in Que Sera Sera, because that's what it was like. You just don't know. You don't know what's around the corner.
New York is the thing that formed me. New York is the thing that deformed me. New York is the thing that perverted me. New York is the thing that converted me. And New York's the thing I love, too.
I learned that the only hope of shaking free of your own description of music was to place yourself in such an untenable position that you had to figure out something new.